It's an ongoing cycle. You're wanting the thing and then you're buying the thing. But if you interrupt that cycle, you stop at the buying part, then you can analyze the wanting part and why you want something. Mm. That's what I'm doing with this no buy or low buy. I am interrupting that thought process so that I can better understand myself. Mm. So I am stopping the car and seeing how I can like change certain things or repair certain things.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, my name is Andrew and welcome to another episode of Chill with TFC, where we chat with the geekiest and quirkiest minds to learn how they think about money and life. Today, we'll be chatting with Lisa. You might know her from her YouTube channel, Lisa's Adulting in Singapore. And she has viral videos like how I bought a resale HDB at 24 years old. She talks about her finances and her budget on her YouTube videos. And if you're curious about how talking about your finances openly changes your relationship with money, stay tuned. Don't forget to stay to the end for our rapid-fire money questions. Hello, Lisa. Welcome to TFC.
Hello.
So Lisa runs a channel, YouTube channel, and it's called Lisa's Adulting in Singapore. Tell us about the channel. When did you start it and why did you get started on it?
Yes, so I started my channel at the beginning of this year, towards the end of last year. So I at the end of the year, I resolved to do a low buy year, which I'll talk about in detail later. But as part of the low buy year, I wanted a place to document my progress with it. And so I watch a lot of YouTube videos. I watch people talk about their low buy or their no buy project on YouTube. And so I thought, it's like two birds with one stone, right? I want to share my progress with this project. And then it was also something for me to do on the side, outside of work. So I started the YouTube channel. There were different options, right? So I could have done a blog, I could have done a YouTube channel, but it felt like a lot of the people I was watching was on YouTube and I wanted to do a bit of video editing, see what I can learn from the work of producing a video, which is why I went with YouTube. And as for the content of the channel, I meant for it to be, and I still mean for it to be, like a video journal of my journey with adulting and all the work that is involved, like from managing personal finance to housing, what it's like to, in my case, live in a HDB flat and manage the HDB flat. I also wanted to go into things like mental health, some behavioral things. But so far, it's been quite a slow start. My content has been quite focused on personal finance. But that is the overall plan for the channel. Mm. Yeah, the main series on my channel is the Money Diaries, which is like a month-by-month recap of how the low buyer is going. And I literally just tell everybody what I've bought for the month. And yeah, and also, my channel name is Adulting in Singapore, right? So I thought the including that Singapore was quite important because it contextualizes everything that I'm talking about. It's a bit clunky, like the whole the channel name, Lisa's Adulting in Singapore, but it stuck. And when I thought about it, it stuck. And yeah, I think for now, that is the name I want to go with.
Mm, it makes sense. I mean, adulting is a phrase that's been talked about in recent years. And on your channel, we don't get to see your face, right? Yeah. So it's actually, it does read like a blog because you've written the script, you know, you structure it and then you present it, but your face is behind the camera. So if you're watching this on YouTube right now, this could be the first time that Lisa has, you know, revealed her face on the internet and all that. So adulting in Singapore. First, how do you define adulting? And since we're the financial coconut, you can define it in relation to money and of course other aspects as well. And what are your first few steps to adulting? How do you get started in adulting?
I guess if you look online, the definition is something like the assumption of tasks, responsibilities, or behaviors that you associate with what a mature grown-up or adult will do. For myself, if I think working backwards with your questions, like what are the first steps to adulting?
When did you first like, okay, I'm adulting. Now yeah. I'm an adult and I have adult responsibilities.
I think it comes with, and the realization can happen at any point of your life, right? It's not really tied to an age, like when you graduate, although that's when it happens for most people. Mm-hmm. You come to the realization that you are responsible for your own life and for sustaining that life. And it can also come together with realizing that you might be responsible for someone else's life. Mm. It could be your parents. It could be your children if you're in that stage already. So it's like understanding that you have that burden of responsibility on you and then taking steps to do the things that would help you support and sustain that life. A big part of it is knowing for yourself that you cannot really live in the blissful ignorance anymore. And I think many associate adulting with very straightforward, like financial related tasks, or like knowing what phone plan to choose, or understanding CPF, or knowing what the heck are taxes and how much you have to pay. And these are for sure like the low hanging fruit of things that you should ideally seek to know more about, not for its own sake, but because these are things that you have to do in the context of the society that you are in. It's part of you having to be, part of you wanting to be a functional member of society in the context of the place that you live in. And so this can differ from place to place.
Yeah, were there any skills that you have to pick up? How did you get started? Like, when did you realize that, okay?
For myself, I think the financial management came before the concrete realization that I have to be the adult now. And that was when I was in JC. For the first time, I got my own money through a scholarship when I was in school. So that wasn't money that I got from my parents as allowance. That was money that was mine. So that was the first time I thought, okay, I have to manage this somehow. Mm. And then I was 16 at the time, which is when you can get an ATM card. So that's when I started tracking what I was spending on. And a lot of it was like food and whatever other things that I could buy online. Of course, at that time, I didn't know about investing. I didn't know about any sort of budgeting framework. All I knew was that I needed to write down what I was spending on and also how much money I had left. So that was the very, very foundation. And then that feeling of adulting, which is also about maturity, right? And not just about the things that you do, but your relationships with people and how you treat them and how you are around them. That maturing is part of the adulting journey, I think. So that came to me much later after I graduated, when I had to start supporting my family. And I knew that I needed to carry myself in a certain way and make decisions in a certain way that is influenced by my circumstances and wanting to have the best possible situation for them with whatever resources we had to work with.
You definitely started relatively younger. You're already tracking your expenses at the age of 16. I mean, well, I wasn't doing that for sure at 16. I was still getting pocket money, spending within it, but I didn't know where the money was going. So it started relatively young. And then you mentioned that as you grew up, you have to also take care of the some responsibilities at home. Could you share a bit about that? Right? And but give us an idea of what that is like.
When I was in my final semester, my father passed away. So he was the primary breadwinner and manager of the household in that sense. So after he passed away, I am the oldest in the family. So I took over because my mother is not educated and she's also not Singaporean. So there were a lot of things that I had to learn. The worst case scenario is, of course, she cannot stay in the country. So that was my perspective. Like, how do I keep her here with my family so that we
can stay together as a family unit, right?
And how... At the time, we were staying with my father's sister. So in terms of having a roof over our heads, having food on the table, that wasn't really the issue immediately. And so I was kind of shielded from that also. So I assumed responsibility, but I think only in name, with the understanding that, okay, the responsibilities maybe will come later in terms of the actual work that I have to do. And it did come later. It came in 2020 when I made a decision to move my family out. And so from there, I had already been working for about 6 months. I was also at the time reading a lot about personal finance. Now that I had an income, now that I had a family to support, I was wondering what is the best way to work with what I had to support my mother. And at the time also, my brother was just finishing up his junior college. And then from there, it's just like a ongoing list of things that I am learning about and executing. So having to buy the house, that was a big thing. And I had to do that by myself because my mother couldn't buy a house, obviously. And I'm the one with the job. And then after getting the house, okay, how do I make the house livable? How do I renovate it? And then what electricity retailer do I go with? I mean, even before the house, I was reading up on investing and what the heck are ETFs and unit trusts and where do I put my money? What is trustworthy? It's just an ongoing list of things that you move forward to learn about, because with knowledge comes power to make educated and intentional decisions. So I was just absorbing everything that I could, learning everything that I could in order to live what I thought was the best life within my means right now.
So the situation with your mom and the passing of a dad, that is really a level up in terms of adulting. And you mentioned about a house. You spoke about it in detail in one of the videos. It's very in-depth, about 15 minutes long, if I didn't remember wrongly. And it was, okay, the title of the video, if you want to look it up, is How I Bought a Resale HDB at 24 years old as a single. So that's very impressive. And it's a very popular video. Many people clicked on it. Mm. All the details are in there. But could you give us an idea so that we can get an idea of what is it about, and then we can look into the video for the rest of the details?
Mm. The video itself is titled How I Bought a HDB at 24 years old. So I mentioned it in a previous video, that how I budget my 3.2K salary, something like that. So a lot of people were already asking, can you make a follow-up? Like, how the heck do you get a HDB at 24 years old? So it starts out with intriguing situation, like how, because the general belief is that unless you are 35 years old, you cannot buy a house you cannot buy a HDB as a single. The thing is, you can, and
then you get resale, then you need capital.
Only resale, and you need money. Yeah. But in terms of the application process, I didn't appeal to anybody in terms of buying the house. I appealed for other things, but buying the house was not one of them. There's a whole list of schemes that determine whether or not you're eligible. And I happen to be eligible through one of the schemes. And because, of course, there are going to be exceptions to the norm. And like the most common exceptions, they will have a scheme for it. Like if you're a divorced parent with children, or you're an orphan. So for myself, it was the non-citizen family scheme where I was applying with a non-citizen parent. So yeah, so that was definitely something that was not known. And so it became an interesting situation, which I put in the title, and I think that's why people clicked on it. The how of it, I covered very clearly in the video, in terms, and also what the process was for buying the house. But I think more interestingly, the why of it is also something that I covered, and it's in the video.
Right, you were forced by circumstances in a way. I think when people saw the title, it feels aspirational.
Yeah, like,
What if, what can I do to, you know, buy a HDB at 24 years old?
I think I shattered that.
Yeah,
I undercut that.
And then it's a bit and switch, and you went into something deeper.
Yeah.
You know, instead of telling me like how, like you really share your own personal situation. Mm. And my takeaway was that like it's really personal. Like everybody's situation is different. And so this is what you have to go through.
Yeah.
As compared to someone who, you know, aspires to, you know, get a HDB at a young age, but you were forced by circumstances.
Yeah, I didn't think about it as being aspirational, actually. Mm. Like the whole time when I was going through the process and even making the video, in my head, it was like, oh, it's a heavy story, like a lot of regret and frustration. Like the thought of it being aspirational or inspiring came a lot later after I published the video. Like even the thumbnail, I remember I took a picture and I put a black overlay on it so that the text can appear more. But basically, it didn't look like, wow, look at me, I did this.
Exactly. Because that's more of your style, actually, which is why you also don't appear in the videos.
Oh, yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You also mentioned another video, how you live on a $3,200 monthly salary in Singapore. And that did well too, right?
That is still the best video on my channel, like the in terms
awesome.
Of viewing.
Goat.
Yeah, the goat.
Goat of your channel, right?
Yeah.
So what is it about? Could you share with us, how did you live on your $3,200 monthly salary?
I think that's my second video on the channel. And when I made the decision to start my YouTube channel, that was one of the first videos I planned to make, because it contextualizes everything, right? Like what's my monthly income, what I'm working with, and why is the lifestyle that I'm living now.
What do you think it blew up though?
Oh, why I think it blew up? So a combination of two things. Firstly, I think it was about February or March that it started blowing up. Like I was getting thousands of views each day, and also a lot of people subscribing, which was insane, because from December, end of December when I created the channel to February, I think I had like 30 subscribers and a few hundred views, which already felt like a lot. But when it blew up, I think, is when the Singapore budget 2022 came out. So I'm thinking with the algorithm and the keywords, because I kind of had all the keywords. I had budget, I had Singapore, I had 2022. So YouTube and Google itself was already, okay, maybe my video, time to push out now, because it intersects with the Singapore budget that was coming out at the time. And then the second thing that happened was there was this really nice guy called Christopher. I don't know him personally, but there is this personal finance group by Seedly on Facebook, right? So he posted my video on there and a lot of people found me through that Facebook group. So those two things, I think, led to my video being pushed by YouTube.
Yeah. Really? You think it's the keyword?
It was, I think,
budget,
so.
Period?
I think so,
are you just downplaying yourself? No, really?
I mean, why else? Because until February, nobody was looking at it. And so it just so happens. And I thought about it. Like, it crossed my mind. Like, do you think maybe during the budget, with the algorithm, YouTube will push my video out?
Okay. Because I'm sure there are other channels that are really budget related. Yours is not even about the Singapore budget. Yeah. It's your personal budget. Just that the keyword is the same. Right?
Yeah. Contact location also the same.
Singapore. Yeah. I'm okay. Sure there are other videos with the word budget in it, but they're not
plus,
blow up.
Plus the Christopher sharing on
Christopher sharing on Seedly.
And if we look at my content, the content of the video, I mean, people understand theory very well, right? They understand, if you read about it, you know what the 50-30-20 rule is telling you to do or advising you to do. But my video itself, I am fully transparent about where each dollar is going. Like, what am I putting towards investments? What am I putting towards fixed expenses and bills?
Before that, could you tell us about the 15-30?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I read about it on Seedly. Mm-hmm. I don't think they came up with it, but I'm not sure. It's a framework where you budget 50% of your salary towards expenses, right. 20% to savings, I believe. Yeah, 20% to savings, which is like your immediate emergency savings, 30% to wealth.
I've seen investments, right?
Wealth investments. Okay. Putting towards retirement or any sort of long-term goal that you have. I think buying a house can be considered wealth. So it's really up to you to define.
There's so many frameworks out there, but of course you have to adjust the percentages to your own scenario.
Because sometimes expenses you cannot really change. So for me, I use that as a broad framework to think about how I should be budgeting my salary, because otherwise there's like a million different ways that you can organize your finances. So just having something as broad as that can help as a starting point. Yeah. And to keep you like in that general direction or trajectory. Yeah. I've seen like 10% for contributions, 10% to parents, 10% like that kind of thing. So there are just a bunch of different ways. I've also heard people saying that maybe 30% to wealth is too much. And 50% is meant to be like for fixed expenses and then 20% for whatever you want to spend on. So it's really up to you.
It depends on your income as well.
It depends on your income.
3.2K is different from 10K, from 20K.
For sure. So for myself, that's the category, that's the framework that I go with because it's just easy to remember for where I am right now.
And 3.2K, I think it's very relatable to many Singaporeans. You know, looking at this number, across some YouTube channels or blog posts, articles, they will have like some crazy figure, right? But your content feels relatable, something that, you know, this is my situation.
Yeah, and to add on to that, because people don't even talk about salary to begin with. So you don't
it's
even...
It's a secret? You think that people don't share about it openly?
Like, don't you think it's like a social thing? People don't really openly share how much they earn. Like, they say, oh, like, I'm quite well-to-do. Yeah. Or, like, I earn high four figures. I don't know. Like, they put it in all these vague terms. So even somebody telling you the exact numbers of their monthly income is rare, I feel. And on top of that, to so transparently share where that money is going, how that money is budgeted. Because context is very important here. You can earn the same as your friend. Like, both of you can be earning, say, 4.5K. But your material quality of life will look so different depending on your situation. Like if you're a single person living with your parents compared to if you're like a divorced mother with two children, both of you earning 4.5K, but your quality of life, your material quality of life can look so different. And so that was what I was hoping to share, like my salary, but also how I am working within this income to lead the life that I'm living now. And you need that kind of understanding of context to have empathy and to feel an emotional connection or a connection that, you know, someone else is going through the same thing as you are. So that's like two sides that I'm hoping to provide in this space. Not just transparency about numbers, but also hopefully a more nuanced understanding of context.
Yeah, I think the context is very important, right? Whether we mentioned 3.2K or 10K, putting 50% of your expenses would mean different things for different people. So it's about your standard of living, your personal choices in life. But what do you think about this whole trend that we are not willing to really share our income? And you put your income out there openly, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Trend of not sharing income. Yeah. I think there are also some company policies,
right? It's not
right?
a trend. It's a culture. Culture would be a better word. Yeah.
A culture also reinforced by some company policies. I think you're not even allowed to talk about salary with your colleagues.
Oh, yeah.
So that one, I am for being open and transparent about it. But I've heard of company policies saying you cannot discuss.
Yeah.
So I really don't know. I think the trend now compared to last time is more transparency, more openness to talking about it. Because I think it's a negotiating point also. And you know, there was a whole thing where it was revealed that female employees are paid less, and like the lack of transparency and discussion around salary
contributes to
that imbalance. So I think the younger generation is more open to speaking about it, but it's not, I don't know, I guess people don't consider it polite conversation also to talk about how much you earn. It's quite an individual personal decision for me to just like, you know what, I don't care. Like, here's how much I earn. I see no shame in sharing it.
Of course, I've read articles that take the position of openness, transparency, because it, like you say, is a negotiating factor for the companies, right? So when HR asks you, what's your previous salary and what's your expected salary, they have all the information, all the negotiating chips are on their hands. Like, you don't know anything, you don't know your budget, you don't know what was the previous person's salary, and you're just going blind. So, and there's just talk about that as well. And of course, you mentioned about women's salary in the workplace being, you know, less than the male counterparts, and it's being unfair. And that's because we don't have transparency on this whole situation. We don't have visibility on it. It's very foggy right now. Yeah, so that's one thing that we can really think about. And someone has to start, right? You put yourself out there first and you say this is your salary.
How am I supposed to talk about my budget if I don't share my salary? I don't know. That was my thinking.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
And maybe there is a very good reason why you shouldn't be sharing your salary to others, let alone online. But from where I am and where I was when I made that video, I didn't see any other way.
Okay, so two of your videos that blew up, one is on your monthly salary and the other one is on your HDB resale at 24 years old. How about something that you like among all these videos?
Oh,
you know, did something not blow up? The video is still there, but you love it so much, like so precious. Why no one is clicking on it?
For sure.
Something like that.
But I think it's also expectations versus reality.
Okay.
I mean, with the 3.2K video and the HDB video, I sort of knew that even beyond me, these videos would travel to a wider audience that is outside of like the core audience that maybe cares about all the videos that I make or most of the videos that I make. The only series and the longest running series on my video on my channel is my Money Diaries. That is the month by month follow up on the Low Buy project that I am doing, right?
Maybe you can go into the Low Buy project So what is Low Buy and what is No Buy, you know? The concept of it.
So low buy is a variation of the no buy. So the no buy year is a project where you basically don't buy anything that is considered a non-necessity. Again, like definitions are all up to you here because what is a necessity to you is different to another person. But the gist of it is that you don't buy anything that is that is outside of the necessity category. And it could be that you do a no-buy on certain categories as well. Like if you identify, say, clothing as your problem area that you want to do a no-buy on, you can just restrict yourself in that category. And you don't buy anything for a certain period of time. It's not a lifestyle thing, because if it's a lifestyle, then it's just your life. But it's more like a short-term project, I would say. It could be a month, it could be a year. And it's kind of like committing to an exercise regime or a specific diet for a certain period of time. I see it in that kind of way. And then the low buy is a variation of that, which means that you impose a certain restriction on yourself. So for myself, it's $50 a month on what I consider is a non-necessity.
Okay.
And people do it for all kinds of reasons. So it could be for something as simple as wanting to save money for that month. A lot of the times I see people doing the no buy because there is something in their behavior or their mindset that they want to change. Or like a no-buy or a low-buy where there is a restriction on the amount or the quantity that you can buy, that you can purchase, that really helps with sort of maybe resetting or helping you reevaluate some of your beliefs and attitudes towards spending. The reason why you put the brakes on spending, right, is because like say you're driving in a car and you think that the car is faulty, you cannot repair the car and drive at the same time. So
you gotta stop.
Yeah, you gotta stop.
Look for help or just help yourself.
The whole emotional process from like wanting the thing to actually buying the thing, it's an ongoing cycle. You're wanting the thing and then you're buying the thing. But if you interrupt that cycle, you stop at the buying part, then you can analyze the wanting part and why you want something, why you think you want something. So that's what I'm doing with this no buy or low buy. I am interrupting that thought process so that I can better understand myself and what my motivations are without like the end result, the consequence of already having bought the thing. Mm-hmm. So I am stopping the car and seeing how I can like change certain things or repair certain things.
Okay. Can I call it a detox in terms of your personal finance? Because you used the diet example just now, right? So it's change your money habits or spending habits. So essentially, it's, like I mentioned, it's not a permanent thing. It's not a permanent lifestyle that you have to stick to, but you can try it for half a year, 1 year. So for yourself, it's been half a year?
Yeah, I've been doing it for 1 year.
1 year. So you've been updating regularly the Money Diaries on YouTube channel. What has been your experience so far? Let's sum up half a year.
Well, it's some of my most vulnerable videos because I'm sharing everything that I bought.
So now so vulnerable.
Yeah. So I'm sharing that. And then also the mindset changes over the last 6 months. I go into depth about that. So I did a mid-year check-in and something that has come up was me feeling quite out of place. Because shopping and spending money is so normal, right? But when I purposely take myself out of that cycle, when I stop driving, it gives you a different perspective. And if you're the only one who has stopped by the side of the road, then you're kind of lonely because everyone's going on without you. And something that I realized was that I don't really know what to do when I'm not shopping or when I'm not trying to actively desire things and work towards buying the thing that I desire. So I've been trying to read more, trying to work more, but I'm not used to not having this pastime. Mm-hmm. And so that has been something that I need to reflect on. Mm-hmm. Like imagine you've been a meat eater all your life and then suddenly you cut out meat. Then you're like, what do I put in my meals?
Yeah, and then all your friends are meat eaters. When you go out for gatherings, they're still eating meat.
Yeah.
And leaving you behind.
What do you do with your time, right? Like when you're not shopping, when you're not actively participating in... I am still participating, but at a much reduced level.
You think parts of our identity, I mean, in this modern society, like, you know, what you spend on is also, it forms part of who you are.
Yeah. So I'm trying to find how else I can reinforce my sense of identity without needing to buy the things to reinforce that identity, right?
So without all this, who are you? Yeah, do you have that thought? Yeah. Like, who am I, you know, in this process?
I think that's a really valuable part of the low buy because it really puts you through this grueling process of self-reflection and self-evaluation. And it's not fun.
You're still mulling over it. You're still thinking about it.
Yeah,
there's no answer.
Yeah, I've never committed to this length of a project before. So we'll update at the end of the year what my feelings are. But right now at the 6 month mark, this is where I'm at.
And that wasn't what you were expecting when you started, right? This realization that you're having right now. Did it serve what you intended for in the first place when you started this low buy year?
Yeah, but expecting it is not the same as going through it. I knew intellectually that I'm going to probably go through some hardship, but going through it is another thing.
Okay. Climbing the mountain itself is another thing.
Yeah.
You know it's going to be tiring climbing this mountain.
That's right.
Going through it is another thing.
Yeah. And a worry that I had was that I'll just give in. I'm just going to give up
in
on
public because you're doing it online.
Yeah, so I think having the public YouTube channel helps.
Yeah, accountability.
But I am committed to the outcome, whatever it is, like whatever realization I come to, the person that I become at the end of this year, I'm committed to seeing it through. Mm. It's just hard.
I'm really interested in this journey of yours. I mean, it reminds me of a friend who quit Facebook. You know, several people have done that, right? Close their Facebook accounts. And then, but what fills up that extra time that you have? I mean, okay, social media detox. Okay, I'm using the word detox again.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison.
Right, and then, so what fills up the time? Like, did you use something else that is the equivalent of Facebook to fill up the time? You know, if you do that, you know, then what's the point, right? Mm. Okay, yeah, I don't really have a clear answer. I have a friend who did that and then she was like saying, oh, I just read more books. But I don't know, is it what she wanted when she turned off her Facebook account?
It's not a one-for-one replacement, right? Like, you just because you quit one habit, you immediately find another habit that can substitute what that previous habit was.
Mm.
So like reading books is not the same as scrolling social media.
Okay.
So I'm sure there was
something else in there.
Yeah.
I think this whole journey of like really
another episode.
It's another episode. It's about knowing who you are. Mm. I think that is what intrigues me, and I might want to do it because of that. Mm. It almost feels like meditation, a form of meditation. In the sense that meditation, well, you go deeper into yourself, you find out who you are. So this process, well, it feels like you could reach that end point. Yeah, we'll check in with you at the end of your end of year review. But you also have to put up all your expenses, everything that you bought online for people to see, right? And people judge you for it, or
how it's experience? Yeah, makes you think twice about what you want to spend on.
Oh yeah, everything you spend on, people will know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So far, no. Nobody has criticized me outrightly about the things that I spend on. I do get comments like, think about your necessities, think about your needs. But the interesting thing is, I am living quite a comfortable life. Like all my needs of survival and safety and comforts are cared for. Like I have put aside money for those expenses. With my, so the things that I do share, I really like, as in the expenses that I share, that I make from my sinking fund. Oh no, should I define that? The expenses that I do share that are the more frivolous things, they are meant to be frivolous. Because I don't want to cut off completely being able to spend my money on things that are purely to give me joy and enjoyment.
Do you recommend people try it? Low buy or a no buy for, let's say, half a year, 1 year?
Would I recommend people do the no buy for sure? Mm. At the very least, it will save you money because you are restricting spending in a certain area, provided, of course, you are not redirecting that money elsewhere and spending more somewhere else. But the potential for behavioral and mindset shifts, I think, is the most valuable part of doing the no-buy project. Like being able to self-reflect and evaluate, it's like starting exercise or a certain diet, but it's not necessary for like financial planning or financial management or anything. It's really like a self-improvement project. That's how I see it.
So you really bear it all online, at least in terms of your financials. You know, put it online for people to discuss, to comment, and you see all these YouTube comments coming in, right? So what has your experience of that been so far? Like, have your perspectives changed because of what you share and then what people commented back to you in the YouTube videos? What did you learn from that? This whole process of putting yourself out there and then you know, having people look at your finances in a spotlight.
In terms of my individual personal guidelines and principles to how I manage my finances and how I think about money, it hasn't changed very much. The difference is that now I have made it public. And so previously when I was just absorbing knowledge, I was absorbing privately, right? And seeing how I can implement it in my life. So now I see what people say about how I've implemented things. It's like suddenly inviting a lot of guests to your house and then having them comment on how you've decorated it.
Yeah.
Whereas before you're just living it, right, by yourself and maybe inviting a couple of friends in.
And that you didn't sweep the floor, you know, things out of place. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been something to navigate. Like, how much weight do I give these comments? The hardest comments are the ones that are like directed at a specific vulnerability, right?
But do we have an example of that?
Somebody commenting how little I give my mother.
That's personal. Okay, I get what I mean. Like, it hits you at a core.
Yeah. It's something very, very like targeted and personal. For all the negative comments that I get, I feel like I get 100 more positive ones. That's what I try to focus on. It's a lot of encouragement, a lot of empathy and connection from people. So it motivates me. Like, it makes me feel happy that I shared what I shared.
Your channel is a breath of fresh air to me.
Because
it's about TikTok, right? It's about quick, snappy, you know, headlines that capture your attention. Whereas your videos could be 50 minutes to 1 hour long, and it really goes in depth and you really spend the time to go into it. So I think it's kind of different. But I'm sure you've been looking at other YouTubers or even other blogs, how they do their financial content, especially in a Singaporean context. Like, what do you think about the whole financial community in Singapore? You've been on Sidley, you've seen all those, you know, posts. What do you think?
Very diverse. And I don't know how much of what I've seen is representative of the actual community. Before, like back in 2020, when I first got my job and I was looking into all these personal finance blogs and channels. And so because of that, I started getting all my YouTube ads were investment, passive income.
Give me 5 minutes then.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, and those were very off-putting, like so irritating. And because they were so irritating from the offset, I just ignored a lot of them. But that all that was happening. And then there was also like the very nuanced and accessible blogs like Seedly, SingSaver. So these are very helpful. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of The Woke Salary Man. I really enjoy their content. All the finance Instagrams were starting and sharing these bite-sized, accessible pieces of information. So it's very diverse and it's being made more accessible. So I think that's a very encouraging direction. I have to say though, generally, I think personal finance is still very male-dominated. A lot of perspectives and a lot of the people who are sharing are men. And it's a different lived experience. So I would love to hear more from women, actually, in the space. And yeah, like all the crypto bros.
To the moon.
Yeah, and the focus on investing and passive income. All of these are common patterns that I see recurring, which is not very aligned with my own values and perspective. So I'm always trying to find a way, find a place where I can sit comfortably and work on my own financial management outside of these voices and other perspectives.
Your channel is where you really share your journey. It's relatively young and new channel. It's been half a year. So how has your personal relationship with money changed? Or over the years, what's your relationship with money right now?
My understanding of money has deepened, like how money is generated, what role it plays in my life. And that deeper understanding is like positive in all the ways that you can imagine. I have better financial management. I have a sense of what is the best. I have a sense of what I think is the best thing to do with my money in my current context.
I haven't asked this and I realize I have to ask because it contextualizes it. So how are you this year?
I am turning 26 this year.
Okay.
So something that I'm still working on is like associating money's subjective worth to my sense of security and safety. Because there is like a baseline level of survival and sense of safety that money has to cover, right? But for a lot of us, that is already that's already covered. There's this really good article by Lawrence Yeo called Money is the Megaphone of Identity. And he talks about money in three phases.
So moretothat.com?
Yeah. So the first phase is security, I think, and then security or safety. Security and then freedom and then power. So in that first phase, security, the bottom end of that phase is of course like basic necessities, safety. But the higher end where security moves into freedom, that is not so much about the amount of money that you have, but your mindset. So how much savings that you think is enough to guarantee that you can preserve your lifestyle the way it is, like for the next few years. And that varies from person to person. So you could have $10,000 and feel very secure. You could have $100,000 and feel totally insecure. And I think that's the stage that I'm at now, where I want to be in a healthier mental space with money and not tie it so much to my sense of security and survival, because I know how much I depend on it. Like in my mind, like if I were to make a misstep, I feel like that could, I snowball into thinking like this could result in financial ruin for me. So I think I need to move into a healthier relationship with money and just in the psychology of it. Because I have done like the best I can and I'm still trying to do the best I can with the technical aspects of it, so the knowledge of it. But the psychological part of it is something that I would like to work on further.
Is this where people's goalposts keep changing? Like you have a certain number in order to feel secure, but once you reached it, then you keep shifting it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also a situation whereby I have this conversation with a married couple, Jingles and Ying Ying, you've met them. So the husband is doing his PhD right now. And so before that, you have to discuss, right? Because you're taking a pay cut to the PhD. And then so logically, you work out the finances, they work it out and it's okay, you know, they can get by. They can still not compromise on their standard of living. But emotionally, that's the hard part, right? Because Jingles will have to take a pay cut in his salary. And so it feels, you know, like, uncertain. There's the psychological aspects that's so hard to quantify.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very nuanced, right? And this kind of thing, you want to talk to people about it. Maybe talk to a therapist, talk to your friends. Okay. Because money is money. It's just dollar bills and numbers on a bank account. But how you manage it, all of that is emotional and psychological. So it's just as important.
Money is money. How would you define money?
Wow, it's just digital digits. sorry. It's just numbers.
Digits on a screen. That's
yeah, digits on a screen.
Digits on a screen. Yeah. Given the way money is right now, of course.
Yeah, digits on a screen that if you don't have it, you're screwed.
Yeah, but hopefully let's not get these digits on a screen.
Controlling our life. Use it as a tool.
Right, thank you.
Hey, I hope you've learned something useful today, and I truly appreciate that you took time off to better your life with the Financial Coconuts. Knowledge is that much more powerful and interesting when shared, debated, and discussed. Join our community Telegram group, follow us on our socials, sign up for our weekly newsletter. Everything is in the description. If you love us and want to help us grow, definitely share the podcast with your friends and on your socials. For more information, check out thefinancialcoconut.com. With that, have a great day ahead, stay tuned next week, and remember, personal finance can be chill, clear, and sustainable for all.
What has been your best and worst investments you've made? Doesn't have to be a financial one. Something that comes to mind?
I thought of a few.
Oh!
I'm just wondering.
We have time.
The first best investment I think was getting a laptop. So I got my first laptop in Sec 1, and that the entire world was, I learned through my laptop. So I think just having that device, yeah, it opened my entire world. And I still think having like a computing device is irreplaceable. Like your phone cannot replace it. Maybe it can now, I don't know. But back then, like getting a laptop was the most life-changing thing. Mm. The second thing I thought about was going on an exchange semester when I was in university. Best investment, because the returns are emotional and more to do with self-development and how I see myself. And it taught me a lot of independence, which has informed my life now. Yeah, two best investments.
Worst.
A Time magazine subscription in JC.
I might have one of those though. Yeah, okay.
So when I entered JC, there were Time magazine salespeople in my canteen, and they were just going up to students. We were, 16 at this time, trying to push for subscriptions of their magazine for like 2 years. I think it's a bi-weekly, so every 2 weeks you get a magazine, right? And it was, I think, $200, $300. And they were trying to sell it to the parents, to the students, saying that it's good for GP, general paper, you want to keep up to date with current affairs. Yeah. So it was very much like fear-based, like FOMO-based kind of selling. And I think I spent $200, $300 of my own money was investment.
And it was not a good investment because you didn't benefit from it? Or
I did not have the time to read through the magazines for what they promised it to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I thought it was quite, what's the word? Not very ethical the way they did it.
I think that's our first experience of sales pitches.
Yeah.
That's the version of give me 5 minutes back then.
Yeah.
Right? And then we're like, oh, okay, I have to buy it because you said fear-based,
and then
right?
They're like all your other schoolmates are buying it. You know, you want to know what's up with the world because this will be useful for your grades, for general paper. You want to know what to talk about.
But you see, these tactics are still being used today.
For sure.
So it works at some level.
Yeah, right. It's our first experience of hard selling.
Yeah, so deeper psychological level. What's one thing under $100 that you think has been a game changer for you?
I have a few. I thought of a few. And I tried to keep it in the $100 range because like no use giving you something that's $20, right? A hand vacuum. So if you have long hair and you shed a lot of hair, a hand vacuum is so useful to just clean up your space a little bit. The second thing is a Fitbit. And I know this is like, can be $170.
You can get it at a discount.
Yeah, yeah.
$11.11 or whatever.
Get discount. Yeah. Use all your Shopee vouchers. You can get it at about the $120 range. Before I got my Fitbit, and I'm not a very sporty person, but I happen to be doing like maybe some running at the time. But now what I'm using it most for is to track my sleep. So now if I don't wear my Fitbit, how do I know how long I've slept for? So I think a Fitbit, game changer in terms of helping me track my sleep. And the next thing is a hydro flask. Sorry, this is not really works, in the spirit of the question, is it? I'm just giving you things to buy.
Doesn't fit into the low buy concept. No, my listeners are thinking, no, I'm going to get this.
Yeah, like a tumbler that, a vacuum seal tumbler. Mm. So that it keeps your cold water cold and your hot water hot. So I got my first vacuum tumbler in 2016, and I've never switched back to a regular plastic bottle because I will never go out of the house without cold water. I will never drink room temperature water ever again. I will always just have cold water with me.
It's good for the weather when
yeah,
it's hot.
Save money, so you don't have to buy drinks outside. And you can put a lemon in there, and you drink more water. I don't know. Do people drink enough water nowadays?
I don't think.
I don't think I would drink the amount of water I do if I didn't have a tumbler. Okay, well, maybe I'll end it there. a good set of wireless earphones that you can get for $100 or more. $100 or less. Mm-hmm. What about you though? Because I'm curious, like, what other people?
I've been asked before. So my answer was a foam roller.
Oh.
So you massage on it. Yeah, it works very good.
Is it very expensive though?
No, you can get it cheap at Decathlon.
Oh, but you said $100. So I thought it must be in
there. You were trying to feed in the question, right? Anything that under $100 that has been really useful for you.
No, there are so many.
Yeah, right. You try it, you know, stretch out your muscles from roller. Okay. Yeah, it works really well. One place that you learn from that you think is underrated that you want to share with our listeners, it could be a book, a website, a blog, podcast.
Yeah, many that I've learned from. And I feel, okay, like Seedly, I think... It's not even underrated, it's deservedly rated because they make it so accessible and still educational for people. I really like The Financial Diet. They're more based in the US, but they do more of the psychological and sociological analysis of managing personal finance, which I think is very helpful. There is also Smart Mamat, which is a Muslim, they talk about personal finance and investing specifically within like the Muslim context. So Sharia compliant guidelines. I don't personally follow it, but the fact that it exists as a resource for people, I think is very helpful for those who want to follow like the Islamic guidelines to investing. I think maybe it's underrated.
Yeah, people can find out more about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've got our co-host for the Sharia Investing episode.
Oh. Or me? Oh.
Yeah, could I get you on the show to, you know, talk about investments? We're going to get people who knows about Sharia Investing because I personally don't know a lot about it myself, and I'm curious to find out more. But it'd be great to have you come on and, you know, ask questions as well. And, you know, we can find out more about Sharia Investing together. Mm, and we can take it offline.
Yeah, I'll think about
all
it.
Right,
yeah.
All right. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.